Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, Creation and Evolution, Part 12. For more resources from Dr. Craig, go online to reasonablefaith.org.
Today we come to the end of our consideration of various interpretations of Genesis chapter 1. We've been looking most recently at what I call the Hebrew or Jewish myth interpretation of Genesis 1, as propounded by Johnny Miller and John Soden in their book, In the Beginning, We Misunderstood. And you remember I explained that there's a fundamental ambiguity in this interpretation as they present it. It's not clear whether they think that these ancient myths were understood literally by the people who believed in them, so that what God did in Genesis 1 was to adopt a sort of obsolete, outmoded worldview, not as a way of endorsing that worldview, but simply as using it as a vehicle to communicate important theological truths about the nature of God and the nature of the world around us. Is that what is happening in Genesis 1? Or is it, on the other hand, that these ancient peoples, in propounding these myths about the creation of the world and its inhabitants, didn't really take them literally? And so it would be unfair to indict them as having a primitive, scientifically obsolete view of the world. Rather, these were figurative stories meant to be taken symbolically to represent metaphysical and spiritual realities. In that case, Genesis 1 is not adopting some sort of outmoded and obsolete scientific worldview to communicate theological truths. Rather, it is itself a figurative story or account of the world's origins that has at its center the teaching of certain theological truths about God, which we summarized in our previous lesson. Now, as I say, Soden and Miller are not clear as to which interpretation they endorse. Last week, we looked at a number of passages from the book that suggest that they adopt the first interpretation, that these ancient peoples actually believed these myths literally, and that Genesis adopts this way of speaking without necessarily endorsing it. Now, for my part, I am very dubious that these ancient peoples actually believed these myths literally. I don't think that they thought the world was really as these myths describe it. For example, consider the Egyptian myths about the creation of the world out of the primeval ocean. According to Miller and Soden, and I quote, "For Egypt, the creation event was reenacted in their experience every day. The time between evening and morning was a struggle as the sun battled darkness and chaos, but ultimately the sun god emerged every morning from the primeval ocean noon and by his daily journey ensured order in the cosmos," end quote. Now, are we to seriously think that these ancient Egyptians actually believed that when they went to sleep at night, they and everything else returned to the primeval ocean, and that then when they woke up in the morning, it was all created anew? I cannot think that that's what these ancient Egyptians really believed. Surely some of them, at least, must have on occasion stayed up all night to see what really happened. Certainly soldiers on watch at the palace would have known that the palace and the pharaoh and they themselves didn't all return to the primeval ocean every night and reemerge. Rather, I think it's clear this is just a symbolic account or a figurative account of creation, and they didn't think that this was reenacted in a literal way every single night when they went to bed. Similarly, with respect to Israel, I don't think ancient Israelis took these stories and metaphors necessarily literally. For example, consider the psalm quoted by Miller and Soden about how God has established the earth on the pillars of the earth. Surely ancient Israelites didn't think that the world was literally resting on pillars. Miller and Soden says, the ancient people may have understood such statements as literal reality because of their observations. But that's obviously wrong. No one had observed the so-called pillars of the earth. Nowhere had anyone gone and seen that the earth was sitting on literal pillars. This seems very evidently, to me at least, a metaphor for the way in which the world has been founded and established by God. But certainly no one had observed such things. Or again, what about the firmament? The Israelites had been to the top of Mount Carmel or Mount Hermon, and they must have seen that there wasn't a sort of solid canopy or dome which was resting on the top of Mount Carmel when you went up there. They would have seen that the sky continued to be an expanse above them in which clouds sailed along and birds flew. There's no reason at all to think that they believed that the mountains were supporting this solid dome that was resting on top of them. In fact, I'm persuaded that if you had showed an ancient Israelite one of these artistic drawings in Miller and Soden's book of what the world supposedly looked like according to these ancient descriptions in the Old Testament, and said to an ancient Israelite, what is this? I don't think he would have recognized that at all as being a picture of the way the universe is or a recognizable picture of the world. This is to ascribe to them a very wooden, literalistic interpretation that is surely implausible. So I'm just very skeptical. I would like to see some solid evidence that would suggest that ancient peoples in general and ancient Israelites in particular interpreted these mythological stories in a literal way rather than a figurative way. Now, on the other hand, there are passages in Miller and Soden's book where they do seem to endorse the figurative or the symbolic interpretation. They do not think, it seems, that the ancients construed these myths literally. For example, on pages 48 and 49, they say the following. We believe that understanding Genesis 1 in its original language and setting leads us to conclude that it is a broadly figurative presentation of literal truths. The text itself leads us to a more figurative approach. Again, later in the book, on page 148, they write, we have already suggested that a number of exegetical details allow for and even point to a broadly figurative approach to Genesis 1 rather than a literal chronological approach. They say this primarily with respect to the 7 days of creation, that these are not chronologically ordered, but I think that their point could be more generally applied to the story as a whole, that it's figurative in nature. Again, they state, and I quote, neither cosmogony, how the universe came to be, nor cosmology, how one understands the universe, including the relationship of the gods. So neither cosmogony nor cosmology in the ancient world was understood in scientific or historical terms, but as symbolic metaphysical explanations or as a means to articulate the incomprehensible and the marvelous while attempting to express such phenomena in a rational manner. They go on to say, we are not saying that Genesis 1 is untrue. We are suggesting that by borrowing the events of Egyptian cosmogony and placing them in a 7-day framework, the author was emphasizing the theological significance for the nation of Israel. He was not making a statement about what he considered to be or what God considered to be a historical timeline, particularly one based on the precision our modern minds require. With its context in ancient Egypt, Israel would not have required or expected, a strict modern historical correlation. The 7 days of creation clearly devastate the theology of the Egyptian first time or single day of creation that is reenacted every day. End quote. So on this view, Genesis 1 is not adopting a proto-scientific, outmoded, scientifically inaccurate cosmogony. Rather, it is, like the ancient Egyptian myths themselves, a sort of figurative or symbolic account of creation that is designed to communicate theological truths that are sharply contradictory to the pagan Egyptian myths with which Israel was familiar. And you recall again what those theological truths were from the previous lesson about God's being the sole and sovereign creator of all things in the universe. Everything else is simply a creature created by God. They are not deities themselves and therefore not to be worshipped or served, nor do they control our destiny. So this puts a very different perspective, I think, on the Miller and Soden Hebrew myth interpretation. And it's not entirely clear to me which one of these interpretations they really endorse. I think it's probably the latter. And I think that interpretation is a good deal more plausible than the first interpretation, which seems to be a kind of 19th century approach to mythology where you read it in a very wooden manner as a proto-scientific attempt to describe the world, rather than as a figurative or symbolic attempt to explain the nature of the universe and of God. So, any questions or discussion about this interpretation? Eric?
I have to wonder, given the how Miller and Soden created their Egyptian creation account by, you know, going through and picking details from a couple thousand of years' worth of material, how much they cherry-picked their data to get an Egyptian creation story with superficial similarities, and if another scholar would come up with a very different kind of Egyptian creation account.
Yeah, that's a concern I have as well, Eric, and I can't answer the question because I'm not an Egyptologist. And as I say, they don't quote the original sources in the book so that we can make these sorts of comparisons. It does lead you to the suspicion that the data could well be cherry-picked. And we've seen, as I mentioned, how that kind of methodology can be abused in historical Jesus studies, and it could be abused here as well. So I do think we need more evidence, basically. I'm not closing the door on it, but I think we need some more evidence if we're to be convinced. Yes, Brad?
I just want to understand something. We don't believe that the Egyptians actually believed the myths, and somehow are we imputing that the fact that the Egyptian story of creation was a myth, that somehow the Israeli story of the creation is a myth or to be taken non-literally?
Well, that would be their interpretation, yes, is that they would say that the creation account in Genesis 1 belongs to the same genre of literature as these other ancient creation myths. And and remember, I emphasize that to say something is a myth doesn't mean in this context it's a lie or a falsehood or a fiction. It's a narrative that attempts to provide a kind of ultimate explanation of one's own society and culture and so forth, such as the Sabbath that you have in Genesis 1. So in that sense, I think that Genesis 1 does have a kind of mythic function. And what they would say is that when you read it against the background of these Egyptian myths, they're so similar in different ways. And I just said to Eric, that needs to be demonstrated, I think, further. But they would say they're so similar in certain ways that this suggests that they should be interpreted similarly. That's the view.
And one more question. I think the underlying premise that they have is that the Egyptian myths and the other ancient creation myths were written before Genesis, because their hypothesis was that, oh, we didn't have writing before 1000 BC. and all. And I think that's false. If the Genesis account were written before these, and these were little fragments were taken, that would explain a lot of that stuff.
Here, I think we have to have a more nuanced position if you're going to defend that, because these texts that are in our Old Testament are written in Hebrew. And so we can get a pretty good idea, probably, of the origins of the Hebrew language and the type of Hebrew that's used that would provide a date earlier than which this text couldn't have originated. But what you could say is that this Hebrew text embodies traditions and so forth that were handed down, perhaps not even in Hebrew, but then were eventually written up and thereby provide a kind of common source that would lie behind both and maybe more of these stories. I think you could say that. And the question would be whether or not that is a defensible position, and I'm not qualified to say.
And it gets back to that tablet theory.
Yes. Yeah, Taiwan?
Genesis 1, I think, stated God's perspective of creation. And we use our own perspective to understand it, and there seem to be figurative. Just as if we try to calculate the solar system, the orbit, and how it all work together from Earth, then everything will be so complicated to a point that we cannot even make sense. But if we transport ourselves to the sun, then everything are orderly. So when God spoke Genesis 1, in his perspective, everything are orderly, but we try to use our own perspective to interpret it, and there are gaps. We just kind of have to go figurative or something.
All right. I don't have any comment on that, but thanks for sharing that perspective. It certainly is true that Genesis has a geocentric perspective, doesn't it? It talks about sun and rising and setting and things of that sort. So that's very true. All right. Well, now we come to summary and implications. And I think that you can see from this survey of various biblical interpretations of Genesis 1 that there is quite a wide range of interpretations of Genesis 1 that have been defended by Bible-believing evangelical scholars. It is not the case that we are boxed into just one interpretation that is valid and sound for anyone who is a Bible-believing Christian. There's quite a wide range of interpretations of Genesis 1. And you might say, well, then which of these interpretations is the best, if any? Which one would you endorse? And here I have to give my candid view. I don't know. I have been studying and reading on this subject for a long time, and I'm still uncertain as to what is the best view. And so I don't have a sort of hard and fast opinion on this, but I think that's all right. I think that the Christian can be open-minded with respect to various interpretations of biblical passages and doesn't need to pigeonhole everybody into just one acceptable interpretation. So I hope that as a result of this survey, it's given you an appreciation for the rich diversity of views that Bible-believing scholars have taken on this passage. And I hope you've enjoyed going through some of these interpretations as much as I have. It's been good for me to review these and to read some of the more recent books like Miller and Soden's in doing so, and I hope you found this stimulating as well. But as far as being able to give a definitive judgment on these interpretations, I'm not there yet. So I simply have to remain open about it. Any comments that anyone might have on that? Yes, over here.
When you're in discussions with non-believers or agnostics, this is one of the things that they often point to as to, you know, the validity of God, the validity of religion, etc. How do you, when you're in those discussions, How do you take that on in your when you're talking?
Thank you so much for raising this question, because you are absolutely correct. As a result of the influence of people like Richard Dawkins and certain other evolutionary biologists, I think one of the main reasons for unbelief, even atheism, on the part of many people today is because they are convinced that Genesis 1 teaches that the world was created in six consecutive 24-hour days about 10 to 20,000 years ago, and that a Bible-believing Christian has to accept that and therefore has to reject what modern science says about the age of the universe, the age of the earth, and the origin of biological complexity. And I hope that this survey that we've just gone through shows how completely wrong-headed that sort of objection is. What I do in dealing with unbelievers when this is raised is just share with them some of these alternative perspectives and interpretations and point out that there are Bible-believing Christians who hold to all of these. And I don't need to propound any particular one. I don't even need to deny that the literal interpretation is correct. All you have to do is to show that you can be a Bible-believing Christian without being thereby committed to the world being 6,000 years old and created in six 24-hour days. And this just completely pulls the rug out from under this objection. So I think this is really, really important material in that sense, in that it pulls the rug out from under what I think perhaps the main reason for atheism or agnosticism on the part of popular culture today. Do you want to follow up? Does that satisfactorily answer your question?
Well, it certainly is an answer. I don't know that in my dealings with some of my son's friends, and you know, when we start talking about this, that they just would, you know, just kind of shrug that off and say, well, you know, tell me something definitive.
Wait, what would they say?
Tell me something definitive, you know. How can you as a Christian believe that in on the backdrop of all the geologic evidence, for example, that there's some sort of a finite and limited creation story?
Well, now, okay, if you're listening now to what I just said, if somebody says to me, how can you as a Christian believe that the world was created in six literal 24-hour days about 10,000 years ago, I would say to him, I don't believe that. And you don't have to believe that in order to be a Christian. I remember when I was speaking at the University of Northern Ireland once, and a student after my talk came up to speak with me, and he said to me, my friends have been sharing with me about Christ. In order to become a Christian, do I have to believe that the world was created in six 24-hour days? And I said, no, you don't have to believe that to be a Christian. And this kid threw up his hands in the air and said, hallelujah! That's been the one thing that has been keeping me from giving my life to Christ. So just explaining to him that there is a range of options was all he needed to hear. And if your son's friends are open-minded, rather than just using this as an excuse for unbelief, they should be satisfied in knowing that as a Christian, you don't have to be committed to these views that they find objectionable. If you hold a Miller and Soden's view, or you hold to a gap theory view, or a day gap view, there's no problem. So say, what's the problem? And ask them to explain what it is. So I think just being aware of these options is very powerful apologetics. Yeah, Bob.
It seems to me that we focus on this part of in apologetics on these questions and these objections they have. But isn't there objection really to whether they are materialists or they can believe in supernaturalism? Because it seems like you move back one step in up the food chain,
yeah,
and really many, many times it's their total denial of supernaturalism in general, which would negate all these various
right.
theories,
right.
whether it was six literal days or 6,000 or six
sure.
million, would be negated that there was, in fact, a creator supernaturally.
Right.
So until you attack that.
Well, I mean, we spent, as you know, Bob, months in this class talking about cosmological arguments for God's existence, fine-tuning arguments, moral arguments, ontological arguments. So this is set against the backdrop of a robust natural theology for the existence of a beginningless, timeless, spaceless, uncaused, immaterial, intelligent, enormously powerful, maximally great personal creator of the universe who is the source of objective moral value and worth. So remember, don't forget our natural theology. But I do say, Bob, in all candor, at least in my talking with high school kids and college students, a lot of times it's not as deep or as sophisticated as what you just said. It's just they think that if you're a Christian, you've got to believe the world was created 6,000 years ago in six consecutive 24-hour days. And they can't believe that. Even good-willed kids, like my friend in Northern Ireland, they just can't believe that. For them, it's like committing intellectual suicide in light of what they've been taught in high school biology and earth science and so forth. So it really is a lot less sophisticated, I think, than the kind of anti-supernaturalism that you're expressing. Now, if it is that, then obviously you've got to go deeper than what I just said.
But what if they, hypothetical, what if they in fact then, based upon not having accepted that as the explanation for creation, later and accept, and they say, well, I'm a Christian now because I don't have to accept that. I'm going to believe whatever science. Well, what if over time, science and or experimentation observation seems to prove that, well, you know what? Maybe it really was 6 days. Is that going to negate their Christian witness?
All right,
their
now, that's Christian an interesting change? Question. I don't think so, Bob, because remember, I think that the literal interpretation is one option that could be right. I think there are reasons to think it's not right, but these aren't definitive. So I am honestly, and I mean this in all sincerity, brothers and sisters, I am really open to a range of alternative views. So it wouldn't be of any concern to me if science were turned upside down and suddenly demonstrated the world was 6,000 years old, I would be delighted. It wouldn't bother me a bit. So I really am open to a diversity of views here, and I think we can, as I'll say next time, I think, therefore, we can let go of this issue theologically and let science tell us whether or not the world is 6,000 years old or 13.7 billion years old. Now, there was a question from Mary over here.
Wanted to make a comment about, I think what we're dealing with is secular, you know, they only see their things one way also.
Now, if I understand you, Mary, what you're saying is that the secularist only sees Christianity as having one view, right, a view that they regard as absurd.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. This objection is sprung from ignorance. They haven't ever read books on this subject. Right. They've never studied Genesis 1. It's pure pop culture that is based on ignorance. So if you can come to them with a more informed and charitable range of options and say, gee, you don't need to be committed to that in order to believe in Christ, I hope that if the person is a sincere seeker, they will welcome that news and therefore be more open to Christ. Okay, we have time for just a couple more questions before we run out of time. Yes.
One of the concerns about this whole topic, about the you say science can tell us and should be able to inform us about these questions because theologically we're safe regardless of what the answer might be. But is that true with Adam? Because it seems to me that Adam is a historical figure. Even in Luke, Jesus' genealogy goes right back to Adam, and it traces through all these historical figures. And so if you could maybe speak to the theological implications there and why that might be a concern.
Yes. Now, here the brother is raising a very good question about the historicity of Adam and Eve. Are they to be regarded as purely symbolic figures, the way some people claim, or are they actually historical persons that really lived? When we get to the section on doctrine of man in this class. We'll take up this subject again of what does anthropology teach about human origins and what does theological anthropology teach. And we'll discuss that question at that time in more detail. I think that the New Testament, as well as the Old Testament, does seem to commit us to a historical Adam and Eve. And so we're going to have to deal with how that is defensible in light of modern anthropology. So hang on to that question until later. Okay, one more question right down here, and then we'll close.
I'm just thinking about the witnessing to non-believer, and it seems to me what I hear is that whether you take what's written literally or as symbolism is really in the mind of the believer, and that the big thought of the world was created in seven days, then the idea is that it is pointing to the fact that God is the creator. And the important thing, if you believe that God is the creator of everything, that's the important thing, not how many days it was created.
Yeah, now I certainly agree with you, and that's the point that Walton and Miller and Soden and Blochet and others are all making. That does seem to me to be central and to be foundational, is that what we have here in Genesis is a monotheistic account of creation that attributes everything to God. And that's especially true, as we've argued, verse 1 is where creation properly begins, not verse 2. Verse 1 says everything in the beginning was made by God. So I think theologically you're right, but I do want to issue a corrective or an admonition with respect to what you said right at the beginning. It's not just up in the mind of the individual believer, whether he takes this symbolically or literally. That leads immediately to subjectivism and relativism. What does the text mean to you? And then each person shares his subjective perspective, and all holds are off then. It leads immediately to a sort of subjectivistic view. Rather, what we're asking here is, how did the author intend this text to be interpreted, and how would its original audience have understood it when they heard it? And those are objective questions that literary scholars struggle with and explore and debate. These are not just a matter of sitting in a Bible study and saying, what does this verse mean to you? Which can be very subjective and relativistic. So we have been struggling here to answer an objective question, but I think that your theological point about what is fundamental and foundational here is certainly correct. It's not the 7 days, it's God as the creator of all. All right, we'll see you next week when we will move on to the concord with evolutionary theories today of biology.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.